recap from last time, we were on part two of what's turning out to be a three-part series on radiation madness, but that's okay because this is really only the second time I think we've done it this way anyway. So we're using you as a laboratory for refining this. And what we covered last time was, what is ionizing radiation? What does it take to ionize? What does it take to remove an electron from an atom and alter the chemical properties of the atom? And we did a pretty, actually worked out really well. Professor Scalise said, I'm surprised it worked as well as it did afterwards. And that gives you a sense of the old mantra, if it dies, it's biology, if it explodes, it's chemistry, and if it doesn't work, it's physics. Okay. So it actually worked. So I guess it wasn't really physics. It must have been something else. We took a Coke can, we put some excess charge on it, and then we took electromagnetic radiation of different wavelengths and therefore different corresponding energies, and we hit the can with that radiation. So the first thing we did was you all took out mobile phones and you called somebody. So in principle, we flooded the room with microwave radiation, okay? And microwave is a word that will come up again later today. Microwave actually means a whole lot of ranges of waves, but basically we're talking about millionths of an electron volt of energy, and it takes a few electron volts of energy to remove electrons from, for instance, aluminum, or to break hydrogen bonds, which are the weakest bonds inside of molecules, for instance, in all of your biological systems. We then hit it with green light from the laser pointer that Professor Scalise provided, and we saw nothing happen. The charge didn't go away. Then we blasted it with heat and visible light from incandescent bulbs. Each of those incandescent bulbs was 60 watts, and there were 9 of them, okay? So that's a lot of power, a lot of light that's hitting the can, and nothing happened. I mean, the little arms moved because the air got hot, and suddenly thermal currents started moving around, but the charge stayed. And then we took this little sanitizing UV wand, which I looked up. It's a 6-watt bulb, 6-watt bulb, okay? Way less power output than those 60-watt incandescent bulbs. And yet, it almost immediately drained all the charge right off of the can. Okay? So UV light can ionize, and anything with a shorter wavelength and therefore more energy, like gamma rays and X-rays, can ionize. That stuff can do physical damage to you. And as we covered in the first lecture, you're exposed to a minimum amount of ionizing radiation every year of about 6.2 millisieverts. It takes 1 sievert all at once to make you sick. Okay? Then we started getting into mobile phones a bit more, and specifically the claim that mobile phones cause cancer. And this claim has been around since at least 1993. This is one of the first documented cases of somebody going into the public sphere and making the claim. And it was David Raynard, and we mentioned him last time. His wife horribly died of a brain tumor. He went on the Larry King Live Show, and he proclaimed that it was caused by her overuse of the mobile phone, although there was no medical evidence at the time that he was basing that claim on. It was just he looked at his wife. She had a mobile phone up by her head a lot. She got a brain tumor. It must have been the mobile phone, even though brain cancer is happening spontaneously every year. Okay? So continuing on with that, there we go. Continuing on with that, we then went into an example of science reporting, how science reporting can echo the myth, and in doing so, it can accidentally misuse actual scientific information, which we'll talk about today. So, for instance, we mentioned this Dr. Deborah Davis, who said that basically if you put the mobile phone in your pocket, you're roasting your bone marrow, and if you put it by your head, she got really upset that the reporter might have her mobile phone by her head. Okay, so that suggests that Dr. Deborah Davis thinks that there's evidence that this is going to kill you by giving you cancer. It doesn't matter where you put it on your body, you're destroying your body somehow. And then we close with who is Deborah Davis? Because one of the things that we like, is, especially in any kind of critical assessment, like when you're writing these research papers, is we like to know why we should believe any of the people that you're talking about, whether they're making the claim or whether they're assessing the claim, okay? So if you can find some biographical information, some how many papers have these people published on the subject before, what are their degrees, what universities or laboratories or other institutions are they affiliated with, tell us, because that's part of the research process. That bumps your research and analysis up if you talk about them a little bit. And then give us an assessment. Should we believe this person? Do they have the credentials and the background? And so we tried to do a little bit of this with Dr. Davis. Now, impressively, until 2009, she was the director of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Environmental Oncology, oncology being the study of cancer. Okay? So who is she? Well, she has a PhD in something called science studies. While University of Chicago doesn't appear to list its science studies program anymore, UC San Diego has one, and there's a good chance that they're similarly patterned on one another. This is very typical among universities to pattern programs on one another. And that's all history, philosophy, sociology. There's no actual, there's no physics course in there. There's no biology course in there. Okay, so she has a PhD in something that actually doesn't have anything to do with scientific research, as we would define it within physics, biology, and chemistry. Okay. She has a master's of public health from Johns Hopkins, again, an impressive institution, but that doesn't necessarily make her an expert in the physics of electromagnetic radiation or in the chemistry and biology of how cancers happen. She held postdoctoral positions at the National Cancer Institute and in the National Science Foundation, but those were in history, sociology, and philosophy of science. Okay, so again, not a laboratory research, not a patient interaction situation. Okay, so that's sort of, I mean, yeah, sure, she's smart, okay, but does that make her credible on the issue of do cell phones cause cancer? It's not obvious, okay? What is her medical and patient experience? Well, she doesn't have a medical degree. So, you know, Professor Scalise and I put these on last time because when I put this on, I basically have the same medical credentials that Dr. Deborah Davis has, none. But it looks pretty good, right? I mean, there she is in that classic white coat. It confers authority in the same way that Professor Fox put on the blazer at the beginning of his lecture. He's a business professor. So business professors should wear blazers, and business professors should be ripped t-shirts and jeans with their hair kind of all over the place, half a beard, things like that, okay? These are images we carry with us. These are powerful images meant to sway you into deferring to authority, okay? And you shouldn't just defer to authority. You should understand why that authority exists and whether it's credible, okay? And most importantly, from a scientific perspective, what I want to know is how many peer-reviewed patients on mobile phone radiation or the link between mobile phones and cancer has she published? And the answer is none. Now, she has a book on the subject, but anybody can publish a book. You can go publish a book. It takes the money, but you find an editor, you find a publisher, that's it. You don't need peer review, okay? So that's not all that impressive, actually. And she has been called upon to talk on the subject, although apart from being available and having this very nice title, it's not really clear why she would be an authority on this. So I'm not doing this to pick on her. I'm doing this as a cautionary tale. One day, most of you will likely find yourselves in a position of leadership. That leadership may not necessarily only cover the areas in which you have expertise. So you need to think very carefully about what you're going to say and how you're going to say it when you're called upon to comment on something by the local news, by national news, by your institution for a press release. If you decide to step outside the bounds of your expertise, it's responsible to start with that. I am not an expert in this, but my research experience qualifies me to assess it how, okay? Something like that. Now, it's possible that the science reporter chopped those quotes out from their CNN article. That's always possible. That's the reporter's prerogative to get the word length right, okay? We don't know. But you have to do the best you can as a representative to represent yourself accurately. And if this is your opinion, you need to say, in my opinion, independent of other studies that have been done. Okay? But it's not clear at all that Deborah Davis did this. And in fact, the fact that she's gone on to head up an institute, a private firm that assesses cell phones, gets the propaganda out there about cell phones and cancer, okay, that already suggests that she has an opinion that she's pushing, independent of the facts. And today we're going to talk about what the scientific evidence actually says. All right, so let me shed my medical credentials here. Okay, so first question from a scientific perspective. There's a claim out there. Mobile phones can cause cancer or do cause cancer. They can or do. So is there an increase in the rate of cancer that happens in correlation with the increase in the adoption of mobile phones? That's the first question to ask. It's a numerical question. Is there a correlation? Not causation, correlation. Because if there isn't a correlation, then there probably isn't any causation either. All right, so remember, don't confuse those two things. But the first thing you can look for in numbers is correlation. Okay, so as an example, lymphomas, gliomas, cancers of the brain, neuromas, other kinds of cancers of the brain or the head area, these are common cancers you'll see brought up in these discussions, claiming mobile phones cause cancer. Okay, so let's talk about lymphoma. So here's some statistics from the from cancer.gov. Lymphoma has increased in the U.S. in rates of incidence by 4% from 1975 to 1991. Okay. Now that rate of increase was roughly equal between males and females. And then from 1991 to 2009, it only increased by 0.4%. Now, roughly when did mobile phones become a common piece of technology, a more common piece of technology? What decade? 90s, right? But when did they first appear in sort of public use? 80s, yeah. Does anybody remember the movie Wall Street? Michael Douglas walking around with that shoe phone he's got against his head with a giant antenna off of it? Okay, you know, that's what they looked like back then, all right? And the technology has advanced somewhat. It's a different frequency range and things like that. It's a little bit smaller these days. What was that?
Somewhat.
Yeah. Well, like you can fit it in an earpiece now, almost. Okay. But if you take a look at the lymphomas, okay, the rate of lymphomas, they've actually slowed in the rate at which they're developing in the population through the decade where cell phone use increased exponentially in popularity in the United States. And again, this is in the U.S. Okay, so I am trying to be consistent with my population. There are other countries where mobile technology was adopted far faster, like in the north of Europe. So when I was first a graduate student, I went out to a laboratory on the West Coast. I was so impressed at how all of my colleagues from Northern Europe were far more adept at using mobile technology, and they were constantly criticizing how crappy that technology was in the United States. Because, you know, they had access to Nokia, and they all had Nokia phones, and they were just so, you know, can't send email on this thing, I can only send text messages and things like that. Okay, and that was 1998, 1999, that I heard complaints like that. Okay, but that's obviously changed. Now, what about mobile phone usage in the U.S.? So here's mobile phone adoption as a fraction of the population. So what they've done is, this is from the British Medical Journal, and they just looked at the number of subscriptions, okay, divided by the population of the United States. Okay, and so that's approaching one. Now, one in principle should be the maximum if you assume each person has one subscription, although we know that some people have multiple subscriptions, like tech reporters, for instance, will often have multiple subscriptions so they can try out the latest gizmo. Okay, but that's not a huge fraction of the population. So we go from 1980, when it's essentially zero, and it slowly increases in rate until you hit the 90s and it takes off. And it's basically linear now. Okay, it was exponential, it's essentially gone to linear at this point. And this data cuts off in 2010, so we're a few years past that right now. Okay, so in the time in which lymphoma has increased by 0.4%, we see a massive increase in the rate at which people adopted mobile technologies that use wireless transmission as the basis of carrying information. Okay, so that's already suspect, but a valid criticism of that is, well, it takes time for cancers to develop. It's possible that maybe that 0.4% we saw through the 90s into the 2000s, maybe the number of cancers has begun skyrocketing. People that used it for 10 years heavily, or people that used it 14 years heavily. Okay, that's a good question. That's a scientific question. We can look at that. So, for instance, here is from the same British Medical Journal publication. Okay, they were looking at U.S. cancer rates, U.S. mobile phone adoption. Here's a plot with data that spans from the early 90s to about the middle of the last decade. Okay. And this blue curve, which kind of bumps up a little bit here and then rises up and then flattens out, that is the observed rate of gliomas, malignant gliomas, forming in people, okay? Independent of whether they got treated or not, just reporting incidents of malignant glioma. That's a really nasty brain cancer, okay? And you see that rate is effectively flat over the period that's being looked at here. Now, what the authors of the study did was, based on some studies of cancer rates in mobile phone users, they made predictions based on the correlation between mobile phone usage and cancer rates in the population studied by those research projects. So there was the so-called Swedish study, which I won't talk about, okay, but it found a slight positive correlation between using a mobile phone and getting a malignant glioma. And if you project the rate at which they see the cancers occurring in their sample, that would have been predicted an increase in the growth of cancers up above about 5 people per 100,000 per year. But that increase hasn't been observed, even though mobile phone adoption has continued to rise through this decade. Okay? So it's still flat. Other studies which saw no such positive correlation, such as the Interphone study, which I'll talk about a little bit later, looked at the case where people had some risk or an extreme risk, and again, they predicted basically flat gliomas based on their data, which had lots of uncertainty in it and so forth, and that's what the data did. The data is essentially flat. So the Interphone study, the authors conclude that there is no correlation between mobile phone use and cancers, and I'll talk more about that in a bit. But based on that study, these authors did a projection of what the glioma rate should look like, and it should be flat. And they have about half a dozen plots for different kinds of cancers in their publication. They all show a similar trend.
Yeah,
That's right. That's right. But this data says that if that latency period exists, it's at least 2 decades.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're right. Within the limits of the study, we don't know that if in the third decade it might take off, or in the fourth decade. Okay. But I'll come back to that point in a bit. Okay. That's a good criticism. That's a scientific criticism. Then the question is, what do you do with that? How do you make policy off of something you don't know? That's the question you then want to ask yourself. Okay. That's a difficult question because there are other things like values and morals and ethics get intertwined, but not the science. The science says over the period of time we've had available to study, there's no evidence of the things happening that people claim are already happening. Okay, that's the key. People are claiming cancers are being caused by mobile phones. That claim is not true based on the data I'm showing here, at least. And again, you can take a look at this British Medical Journal study. I put the link down here. The slides are available off the syllabus now. So if you click on Radiation Madness, you'll see the link to the PDF file at the top of that next page. That page is still developing based on these lectures, but the slide is complete. Okay. Okay, so now we've looked at this. Okay, we've looked at mobile phone usage. We've looked at cancer rates, gliomas, lymphomas. For these common things that people point to as being caused by mobile phones, there's no evidence so far of a link. So are there any scientific claims of a link? Have any researchers who actually go into the lab and test questions like this seen evidence of a link? Okay. Well, if you do enough studies, of course, you expect some of them to show a positive, and then you have to go and check those studies and see if that positive is real or just a statistical fluke. So let's take a look at a positive study, all right? So this is a study that gets referred to a lot by Rapaccioli and colleagues, and it looked at the rate of, again, lymphomas. Okay, so here's lymphomas again. In a certain kind of genetically modified mouse, okay, these E-micro-PIM1 transgenic mice. Did I say that right to anybody majoring in biology?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so this is a kind of mouse that is more predisposed to developing lymphoma. Okay, so essentially this genetically modified mouse is designed to develop cancer more quickly. It's more sensitive to the kinds of things that can cause cancer. So that allows you to do compressed time studies of cancer development in the population, whether external factors accelerate that rate even more or not. Okay, so in that's why you would use something like this in principle. Okay, but if keep in mind, it's genetically modified to get cancer at a higher rate. So you want to be a little bit careful about what conclusions you draw of it and what control samples you use. Okay, what are the controls for this? All right, so what they did was they pulsed populations of these mice either with sham radiation, so a device that presumably looked like it emitted radiation but didn't, okay, had no batteries, no movements, no working parts, nothing. And the other half of the population was exposed to 900 megahertz electromagnetic field. This roughly corresponds to mobile phone radiation. Okay. So they used 201 genetically modified mice. 100 were in the control group and they got sham radiation, as the authors call it. 101 got exposed to radio frequency electromagnetic radiation. And what the researchers concluded was looking at this population of those exposed to EM radiation versus those that were not, that the odds of a mouse in the group exposed to electromagnetic radiation at sort of mobile phone frequencies was 2.4 times higher, more likely to develop cancer, lymphoma, than one in the sham exposed group. Okay, so
why did
they
have the one extra mouse?
Maybe it broke their budget. I have no idea. They don't come out and say that. Right, why they had to do it. But one, that shouldn't be the deciding factor.
Yeah,
now.
But it just
yeah.
Looks-
Yeah, okay. Well,
but, you do that?
Well, you do. Sometimes you have to do science with the resources you have. Right? That's just the reality. You know, you may not get funding for one more radio or genetically modified mouse. Do you know how expensive these things are?
Not
200. Oh, 200. So, oh, yeah, just leave one out and see if there's a pet.
Number.
Probably a baker's dozen. Maybe somebody, you know, something.
Well, that's true. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Or is it like scaled down?
Well, okay, so I can't remember the exact numbers, but they were exposed something like a total of a few hours per day to the radiation. So they were trying to emulate mice making phone calls and talking on the phone for a few hours a day.
Like our phones, like a big...
Well, it's the same power settings and the same frequency as what we would use. This is 1997. So this would have been using something that's more akin to the technology we have today, GSM band. Well, that's possible. So you're raising the scientific question, how do you scale from mouse biology to human biology? That's a question, right? And that's not an easy one to answer. But we'll get to that in a bit, because you can actually do studies on humans. People have been using mobile phones for a long time, and that data does exist about cancer rates and mobile phone usage. So I'll show you some of that. Okay. But yeah, so this would suggest that a biological system could be induced to develop cancer at a higher rate. Granted, it's a mouse biological system, but mice are often used as analogs for some things. For human beings, prior to human trials, for drugs. For instance.
I can also argue that mice have like opposite.
There's less shielding material, right? For instance, yeah. So for instance, our skin is thicker, for instance, than mouse skin. So maybe that absorbs more of the gamma radiation before it gets to the
organ. Yeah, like we have 70 kilograms.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there's the scaling issue. Did they scale the experiment correctly?
Might not necessarily be smaller.
Anything else that's important? Yeah. Cancer studies like these are not scaled. When the group was testing whether the saccharin causes cancer, the mouse equivalent dose, if you scale it up to the moon, was 800 cans of diet soda per day. Because you're not trying to make it realistic. I mean, you'll wait forever for that experiment to do. You want to overdo it. You want to give them a lot of test material.
Sure.
It's not going to really.
If you do it with a lot, then it won't be with a little.
Right.
Well, that's another thing that's built into these is that the dose makes the poison in a sense, right? But there's actually even people now that repeat that claim. Not entirely. Well, we'll get to homeopathy. That's part of the dose that makes the poison, I guess. But there's even outside of homeopathy, there are other people now claiming that less is worse. Okay, well, that's something we can talk about with the other medical claims. Okay, what do we want to do? So we have a study in 1997. It showed these results. What do we as scientists want to do? Yeah, okay, look at the data, but what if they won't give us the data? Or do something more positive. Review the experiment independently, right? They should say enough in the paper that you can redo it. And in fact, in the abstract, they get very clear guidelines about how much exposure, what power, things like that. Okay, so even if they were to hide the text of the paper from you from their abstract, you could still kind of replicate the experiment. Okay, so people did that. So there were many attempts to reproduce Repetroli at all. The independent studies typically used larger populations of mice. They used more exposure. They used more groups. So they divided a larger population into more groups that received different degrees of exposure, for instance. And they also used mice that both were and were not genetically modified to see if that had any effect, okay? So have multiple control groups. And the other studies that followed up on this could not repeat the positive result. So these are two examples, for instance. Here you have one by Utteridge et al., and then this one by Summer et al. And this one used the same transgenic mice, long-term exposure to 900 megahertz microwaves, and they found it did not increase lymphoma incidence. And similarly, the Summer et al. Group found the same result, that they could not induce a decreased survival rate due to lymphomas in mouse population. Okay. Again, this is using GSM, obviously. The GSM band is common in mobile phone technology. I think my iPhone uses it. Okay, so replication. Replication is the essence of drawing a good scientific conclusion. If there's truly a positive result and it's real, that other people, independent of the ones who made the claim, ought to be able to reproduce the conditions of the experiment and reproduce the outcome of the experiment. And here are two examples where independent groups could not, in fact, do that. Okay, although Repetroli is still raised as scientific evidence that mice can develop lymphomas from exposure to mobile phone radiation. So that's cherry picking, right? That's picking the result that supports your belief and ignoring the two in this case, although there are more, that do not. Okay, cherry picking.
Let's also point out that if there were any effect, no matter how small, increasing the population of the mice and increasing the exposure to increase the effect,
right?
Not mask it,
right? you can't hide a small effect in a larger population. So if it was a small effect, you would be more prone to notice it with more months than, you know, rather than less prone to notice it with more months. Okay? All right, but let's talk about people, right? Because those are mice. What about people? So there have been a couple of major studies that have been done, but let's go back to the physics for just a moment. Because remember, just because you can think something is possible doesn't mean it's physically possible. There's no physical law that may support your belief, even if in your mind you can conceive it. And we went through this last time, okay? So mobile phones, can the physics of a mobile phone, can the chemistry and biology of cancer fit together in a coherent picture? If you can't make them fit together, then you're already lacking a physical explanation for why this even might be so. Okay, so can mobile phones cause cancer? Well, we looked at ionization. Mobile phones could not remove the loosely bound electrons off the aluminum pan. It took UV light to do that, which is much more energy, a million times more energy in the wave than mobile phone radiation does. So mobile phone radiation is restricted to these bands by the Federal Communication Commission. All right, so anytime you buy a phone, it's probably within this range. Actually, that should be 1989.8. I'm off by about 80 there. What energy is transported by this? Again, millions of an electron volt. So you can't even break the weakest chemical bonds with this radiation. Okay? So mobile phones, from a physics perspective, can't by any of the known mechanisms that cause cancer. Okay, but they're microwaves. And microwaves can cook food, right? So shouldn't they be able to do serious tissue damage by holding that thing up to your head for so long? Okay, well, let's think about that. Your microwave oven. How many people have a microwave oven or access to one? How many people use the microwave oven to cook food? Okay, a lot of people have. Microwave oven energy frequencies. The frequencies for these are around 2.4 gigahertz. Now, if you correct for the fact that I used megahertz on the previous slide and gigahertz on this one, gigahertz are 1,000 times more than megahertz. That's only about 25% higher in frequency than the GSM band. So it's outside the GSM band, which is good, because otherwise if you had a tiny puncture hole in your microwave oven, it would completely interfere with your phone calls every time you use the microwave oven. Okay, that's the reason the FCC restricts these things to certain bands. But that's only 25% higher in frequency, and therefore only 25% higher in energy, okay, per wave, all right, than the highest frequency mobile phone radiation. So again, we're talking about, you know, 10 millionths of an electron volt. Can't break a chemical bond. So how does a microwave oven cook food? Well, fats, water, all that stuff that's probably in your food items, possess varying degrees of what are called electric dipoles. These are just displaced positive and negative charges that are bound together. And so when they feel an electromagnetic wave, they can oscillate in response to it, they can vibrate, okay, they can rotate. Dipoles do that. All right. So what happens is that these waves, much like the waves hitting the boat in the analogy I gave you last time, they rock the dipoles. Moving dipoles means that things collide in the food, and collisions of stuff in your food is heat. So that's where the heat comes from. It's collisions. It's energy transfer from the wave, the vibration and rotation of the fats and water inside your food, and that causes heating. Okay. So, but that's only true when sufficient power is present in the wave. Okay. If there are enough sort of waves per unit time hitting this thing, then you can do some cooking. And it usually takes a few minutes after power is present in microwave ovens to cook something thoroughly. So is your mobile phone cooking your brain? Okay, your brain's cooking fats and water, right? Well, microwave oven power is typically 700 watts, and a watt is just a unit of energy transmitted per second. So that's more energy per second than a microwave oven is dumping into biological material inside of it. Okay, mobile phones typically operate at most at a few watts. Okay, so it's a few hundred times smaller power than a microwave oven. Okay, so does cooking, that is thermal heating, cause cancer? Well, you certainly get, or at least damage of some kind, like roasting your bone marrow, as Deborah Davis said. All right, well, you certainly get more heating in your head from sitting outside on a hot day. Solar power at the Earth's surface in Texas, for instance, varies, but it's between 200 and 300 watts per meter squared. Okay, so your head is, well, actually your whole body, but let's just take your head as what, maybe a half a meter squared, quarter of a meter squared, something like that. Okay, so a half to a quarter of that is what's going into your head when you're sitting outside on a hot day. Okay, now, do you get cancer from the heating of your head in the sun? Not that anyone knows of. You can pass out if you're not circulating blood well enough that day, because blood carries heat away from excess heat away from parts of your body and cools you. Okay? Your blood, your circulatory system, is part of the mechanism in your body to regulate body temperature. If it didn't exist, you'd walk out in the sun and pass out. Because that change in temperature is significant. That's a lot of energy going into your head all at once. And your brain doesn't like it when the temperature varies too much, right? What is it? Brain death from a fever happens around 108 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're talking a 10 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature in your core body temperature is lethal and can lead to brain death. Sun can easily raise the temperature of something 10 degrees Fahrenheit. You have a cooling mechanism in your body for a reason. Okay? So blood flow regulates body temperature, and you're in much more danger from heating just sitting outside in the sun talking to your friends, never mind the little, you know, watt thing you've got called up to your head. Sun is way more bad at heating than your mobile phone.
But exercise.
That's a great example. How many people exercise in this room? Okay? Yeah, right? I mean, you go from 75 beats a minute to 150 beats a minute, for me at least. Okay? That's a lot of heat. I mean, you're sweating. There's a reason you're sweating. Your body's trying to regulate body temperature, both the blood flow and sweat. Excretion of water, carrying heat, excess heat energy away from your body. Okay? So you have mechanisms to adapt to heating. Otherwise, you'd be dead already. So it's very simple. Now, why is sitting out in the sun bad? Well, sitting out in the sun is bad for another reason. It's not this. All this stuff does heating up here. Okay, so this is the wavelength of light present in the red at the Earth's surface. So that's what comes in from the sun in yellow. And then because we have water and CO2 and other things in our atmosphere, some of that gets absorbed, but not all of it. And the part you need to be worried about is this little tail down here into what's known as the UVC and UVB bands, which is why you should probably put some sunblock on if you're going to be spending more than about 20 minutes out in the sun. Or dress up, long sleeve, something like that. Okay? That's why the sun is bad for you, but it's not the heating that's the problem unless your circulatory system isn't working. Or unless it's an extraordinarily hot day outside. Heat sickness is not pleasant for anyone who's ever had cancer. But it doesn't cause cancer, it just causes vomiting and headaches and all kinds of other things, passing out, which is not good. Okay, but let's focus on mobile phones. So what does the big data say? What are the long-term studies of large populations of people have to say about this? Okay, well, one of the big studies that originally came out in 2006 and was updated in 2011 is known as the Danish cohort study. Okay, so this is an example of the publication page for this from the journal site. Okay, so if you're not seeing things like this in your research, you're not looking at the right page. You need to dig down past the Central University Library reference for a record. Okay, and they give you all kinds of useful information, even in the abstract. Okay, so even if you're running out of time to write your paper and you need to know something to put in your paper, at least read the abstract and conclusions and give us a sense of what they did. That they talk about blinding. Okay. And other things like that. Right. So, the Danish cohort study. Denmark's national healthcare system, okay, let me say it again, national healthcare system allows them to collect and analyze a vast amount of health data. It's one of the positive benefits of having public information. Now, granted, it's sanitized of things that would be necessarily personally identifiable, but you can get things like addresses out of this, or you can link names and addresses to health records and things like that. You can look at cancer rates, for instance. They let people do that in Denmark. The health data was then linked by researchers to mobile phone subscription data, which they also had access to. Okay? So information about who has a subscriber plan, what address, and what their health record has been on cancer, for instance, can all be linked together in Denmark's healthcare system. And so the study in 2006 originally included about 420,000 individuals, and the data spanned 20 years. And it was updated in 2011. I'll show you the conclusion from that, but both times, they found no evidence for a relationship between various head or nervous system cancers and the use of mobile phones. And what they were looking at was, when did people get their first subscription to a mobile phone? How many subscriptions have they had over time? How long have they had a subscription? And they can figure out from first subscription to now, or when they canceled their subscription and picked it back up and then kept going, did they develop certain kinds of cancers in those periods? Were the cancers associated with places where you would hold the phone? Were they here, for instance, in your pocket, or up here in your head? So they looked at all of this information, and that information is available from the health records. And what they found was, this is the updated study using 358,000 subscription holders. In the follow-up period from 1990 to 2007, there were about 11,000 cases of tumors of the central nervous system, okay? The risk of such tumors was close to unity for both men and women. Okay, so men and women roughly equal in that case. And when restricted to individuals with the longest mobile phone use, that is 13 years of subscription, the incidence ratio was 1.03, which is 3% higher than 1. All right, but at 95% confidence interval, the true value lies somewhere between 0.83 and 1.27, entirely consistent with 1. So that is no increased risk based on long-term usage. In men, and it was 0.91 with this range for women, again, consistent with 1, no increase. And among those with subscriptions of 10 years, okay, this was a larger population of people. Again, there's no evidence whatsoever for an increased risk over the population in general. Okay? So basically, there's no indication of dose response relation either by use since first subscription for a mobile phone or by the anatomical location of a tumor, which would indicate whether or not it's associated with holding the phone here or throwing it down here. Okay? Now, that's not the only study that's been done. There's also the interphone study, and this has already come up before. When I mentioned, I think it was when I was talking about Deborah Davis, okay? Because she likes to use this in her, it was her post on the, it was her article on the Huffington Post that I linked to in here. She likes to use the interphone study, but she likes to misuse it, okay? So what did the interphone study actually do, and what did the authors of the study conclude? It was published in the International Journal of Epidemiology. It was an interview-based case control study spanning 13 countries. So a different means of collecting information from a different population. Okay, it's not just Denmark anymore, it's 13 individual countries. And each country, the analysis was carried out separately, but a common protocol was established for all 13 studies. Okay? And basically, the short version is that they also found no evidence for a relationship between brain and nervous system tumors, and this came out in 2010. Okay. So here's some of their conclusions. They actually have two different publications, one on gliomas, and the other one on neuromas, okay, acoustic neuromas. So here are the conclusions from those two. Overall, no increase in risk of glioma or meningioma was observed with the use of mobile phones. There were suggestions of an increased risk of glioma at the highest exposure level, but biases and error prevent a causal interpretation. That's the authors speaking from experience on their own data analysis here. But they do go on to say the responsible thing. Rather, this is the point you made earlier. The possible effects of long-term heavy use of mobile phones require further investigation if you want to sort this out, okay? So there's no strong scientific evidence that there's a problem with the high level of exposures, and certainly the Danish cohort study suggested that wasn't the case. But if you really want to sort that out, you need more time and more data. That's what the science can say, okay? But there's no reason to freak out, okay? From their acoustic neuroma paper, they basically concluded the same thing. Ever regular use of a mobile phone or for users who began regular use 10 years or more before the reference study, they then found elevated odds ratios observed at the highest levels of cumulative call time, but they could be due to chance, reporting bias, because it's an interview-based study, or a causal effect. They're not ruling out a causal effect. As acoustic neuroma is usually a slow-growing tumor, the interval between introduction of mobile phones and occurrence of the tumor might have been too short to observe an effect, if there is one. Okay? So they're being responsible within the limits of their data. That's okay, all right? So maybe we can't draw a conclusion from this study alone at the highest levels of exposure, 10 years or more. The Danish cohort study is much clearer on that. But from this one, it's a little bit more muddy. And so if you want more data, you need more time, you need more people, okay? So the conclusions from the scientific evidence are fit from the laws of physics and chemistry and biology, from the known mechanisms that can cause cancers, there's no ionizing radiation from mobile phones, and so they cannot cause cancer. Is cancer observed due to mobile phone use? No. Independent large population studies have found no strong link. Okay. There's also no convincing observed correlation with increased mobile phone use in cancer plus lymphomas or glioma. Now, in the last few minutes here, what I want to do is talk a little bit about the consequences of public thought on this. Okay. So you might be asking yourself, at the highest levels of exposure, maybe there's an effect, so I'll never use a mobile phone again. And I'll call all my friends to stop doing it, and I'll set up a website for them. Lots of people do that. But what's so bad about people wanting to believe that mobile phone radiation is bad for them? Well, here are a few reasons. And it all has to do with money, basically. Wasted money. Okay, so in the law. Recently, the Italian Supreme Court, you may have heard about this, they ruled in favor of a man claiming his mobile phone caused his cancer. Okay, so the lower court said, no, you don't get damages for this. The Supreme Court overrode them, and that will stand in Italian law. But the court, they made it very clear that they weren't even going to consider evidence that was even partially funded by the mobile phone industry, such as the interphone study, which which is the only one that found maybe a positive correlation between mobile phones and cancer at the highest level. So oddly, partially funded by the mobile phone industry, only one that showed any positive correlation with cancer, but too weak to really make a claim off of it. Danish study, not funded by the mobile phone industry, no evidence of that at the highest level of exposure. The Italian Supreme Court ignored that finger phone study. This presumably opens the door then to other cases in Italy. So lawsuits can now proceed against mobile phone manufacturers on something which has no scientific merit whatsoever. And I think this is a very useful illustration of how legal truth, the ability to win an argument, is vastly different from scientific truth, and those are not always aligned with one another. Okay. Scientific truth is concerned with establishing the reproducible knowledge of the natural world that can be used to build new knowledge. Okay. Wasted money on products. Thanks to Professor Scalise for finding this. Here's a website called Belly Armor, and they advertise a radiation shielding. Presumably, it's just aluminum foil and an attractive cloth thing. And it shields everyday radiation with 99.9% effectiveness. And you see here the pregnant woman, and she's holding a mobile phone right by her belly, because now it's safe because she's wearing body armor over her company. Okay. You're throwing your money away on this if you think that this is going to be causing cancer in yourself. Okay. Maybe you should worry more about your diet and less about your mobile phone use. Okay. Things that we actually order, your health. Are you getting good medical care while you're pregnant? That has a much stronger influence on the outcome of the child's well-being than whether or not you call your friends twice a day. Okay. Wasted money, government legislation. So you were wrong. Dennis Kucinich is still a congressman in Ohio. This came from August 6th of this year. Okay. So this is not that long ago. Cell phones and brain cancer? Until we know for sure, Kucinich urged the Cell Phone Right to Know Act. And he cherry picks the Interphone study to draw this conclusion, or presumably one of his staffers does. What's wrong with this? Until we know for sure. Will we ever know for sure? No, we'll never know for sure that cell phones don't cause cancer. You can't prove that, okay? You get, maybe it's one more study. Maybe it's 500 more years of evidence, okay? So that's it. That's where I wanted to end on this. So oddly enough, this one ignored Danish cohort and used Interphone to draw the same conclusion other people who ignored Interphone's group. So thanks very much, everybody.
Very nice.